So in the last lecture, we reached, oh, I'm missing a hat too. If I'm going to put the hats, I'll go all the way. So in the last lecture, we saw how to deal with the coupling, at least without involving different frames or anything, relativistic interchange frames or trajectories or anything, any considerations. We saw how a hydrogen-like atom couples to the electromagnetic field. And then we analyzed what people historically did to try to compute probabilities of transitions in atomic physics when you treat the field not only classical but also quantum. So effects related, by the way, something that I always mention this. If you haven't heard it, let me just say it again. You can do new phenomenology, of course, when you have quantum electromagnetic fields. It's in popular culture, it's very often said the photoelectric effect is proof that light is quantum. That is false. The photoelectric effect is not proof that light is quantum. You can get the photoelectric effect, except for vacuum corrections, with a classical electromagnetic field. If you want to check how, in my quantum mechanics notes, it's the last calculation of the course. So you go to the last block. So you can get it classically. But there are other phenomena that is coming from the quantum nature of light that you can explain with this, and people wanted to do it, wanted to explain that, explain phenomena, for example, on sudden death, quantum beats, et cetera, et cetera. And they had attempts to it, and the first attempt was the usual like fundamental theory, oh, let's go minimal coupling, let's work with the field A, but then they made gauge assumptions that kind of inconsistent gauge assumptions and had problems. Maria Goeppert-Mayer kind of solved the thing by saying, no, let's fix the Poincaré gauge, which happens to be in the approximation we're going to use it, the gauge in which the textbook wave functions for the hydrogen atom are given, and let's stay in the dipolar approximation. And then we ended up with this Hamiltonian that I have there, which is missing a hat as well. This Hamiltonian here, which couples the dipole density of the electron of the in the atom to the electromagnetic field. And the atom sees the field only is integrated on a function that is not strongly supported everywhere. I mean, the support of this function is kind of everywhere because this is an atomic wave function. And we will discuss more about localization later on. But these wave functions are strongly suppressed far away from a region, call it A0 if you want, some length scale of the atom. And strong suppression is a physicist kind of concept, not a mathematical kind of concept, which is basically the smearing vector modulus, if you want, is less than one, much less than one, everywhere except for a finite region. So again, this is a physics kind of strong support as opposed to compact support, if you want. Okay? Lives mostly near the center of the atom. All right? Questions or anything? All right. So now we got this, and we're going to start making approximations on this to simplify the physics. Because you see, oh, by the way, the electromagnetic field here, I expanded in terms of a plane wave basis that you can do in flat space-time, no problem. And this plane wave basis that we have here, well, all the elements here you probably know, this is a polarization vector, right? This is a creation annihilation operators associated with plane wave modes. And of course, I'm going to be using natural units throughout, all over the place. Okay, so h bar equals c equals 1. That's what I call natural units, by the way. I don't make g equals 1. I want to have units, as in like some unit scale to refer to. And because it's a massless field, the dispersion relationship is as simple as that. All right, so let's start making approximations. So what we're going to do today is going to do the approximation that is most often used when we use particle detectors, the one that started in the 70s with Andrew and DeWitt. And we're going to compare, because in parallel to this, people in quantum optics develop their own models, which is also, let's start making approximations, because this is too unwieldy to work with in the lab. I mean, computers can do it, but you're going to get, if you actually need to do atomic transitions and so on, you're going to get difficult integrals, and you're going to get a lot of modes contributed. Maybe even divergences, if you're not careful, maybe. It depends on what approximations you actually do. So people say, no. Let's simplify things. So in parallel, two different kind of sets of people did different approximations. And we're going to go through the Andrew DeWitt way, and then we're going to introduce all the way to current day quantum optics, most textbook quantum optics. And we're going to compare the two and discuss a little bit about these approximations and relativity and so on. So that's going to be at least most of the first part of the lecture today. So what's the Andrew DeWitt model? So the first approximation is saying, OK, cool, yes, the electromagnetic field is a vector field. And of course, you couple with a dipole. Right, but if I'm not, I don't care too much about exchange of angular momentum, so if I don't really, if my physics is not dominated, if you want, if the physics you want to describe is not dominated by exchange of angular momentum, maybe I can do an approximation where I approximate the electromagnetic field by a spin zero field, by a scalar field. So that's the first kind of approximation, if you want. It's the scalar version, so if I were to do an interaction Hamiltonian that mimics that one, but it's a scalar version, what do I do? Well, let me call the coupling strength here lambda, because that's a common name for the coupling strength. And then, let's see. So it's some density of, here is a dipole density, what we have. Well, it's a scalar field. You're going to couple with a dipole. You're going to couple with what? Who can tell me that? What would be the leading order coupling to a scalar field? No? You've seen that 1,000 times? You have a scalar potential? Can a charge generate a scalar potential? Like a Coulomb potential, if you have a negative charge or something like that? Right. So what is a charge? In terms of multiple expansion, what is a charge? Tell me, yeah, you know it.
A monopole.
A monopole. So instead of having a dipole density, we're going to have a monopole density. And let me call it, because usually, let me call it M. And in M, I put dx. And that monopole density will couple to a scalar field. Right. So the monopole density here, M, of Tx is going to be some smearing function. Now it's not a vector, of course, it's a monopole, not a dipole. And the smearing function multiplies sigma x, if you want, in the interaction picture. Notice that I'm assuming here that the smearing function is real, just for convenience. Here already we're doing an approximation that messes a bit with the shape of things, because we lose the general shape kind of thing when we introduce a monopole approximation. Still, it's a density of monopoles, a monopole distributed on the, if you want, you can cherry pick this to be the shape of the atom, if you want. But there's no point in considering it complex in general. It's not going to add anything new. Already we are, the level of detail that you get with the complex one here, right, is lost already when you do monopoles, so there's no point in keeping it complex. So for simplicity, let's consider it a scalar function. And yeah, we have also a scalar field, and the scalar field we can expand in plane wave modes. And we get something like this, 2 pi cube, and then modulus k, and then we get a dagger k, and then the plane wave I kt, modulus of course, right, minus kx, plus the Hermitian conjugate. All right. So what we've done here, I mean, look at the two Hamiltonians. They look pretty similar. It's basically say, well, say that my field is scalar and my coupling is monopole coupling, but this is just a straightforward way of writing that. This model was introduced in the 70s without thinking of the light matter interaction at all. Was introduced in the 70s by DeWitt, actually. Because Andrew first said, I want to measure quantum fields locally. measuring quantum fields is tough, so I'm gonna get a box, which is like a cavity that contains another field, and that field's, the cavity walls are transparent to the field number one, not to field number two, so they would couple inside the cavity and so on, and then the wit arrived and said, hold on, if you only want to get local information about the field, get the simplest, don't put a cavity in there, which is a full field theory, put a two-level system. And the wit suggested, let's use a two-level system. So basically they said, oh, this is the coupling of a two-level system, and in fact, when it was first introduced, by the way, this guy, let's call it mu of t, when it was first introduced, and for many people, what people would call the Andrew DeWitt model is point-like. So this would be a delta function. Delta x, for example, center at zero if you want, and then you integrate that and the integral disappears. So oftentimes, if you see in the literature the Andrew DeWitt model, they would refer to the point-like Andrew DeWitt model. By the way, DeWitt all capitalized. The sitter has done a lot of harm to the wit because people often write the small d there. No, it's a big D. Okay. So point like Andrew DeWitt, which means f of x is some delta. Put it somewhere if you want. In this reference frame, it's not moving. We will talk about that later. And if you do that, of course, the Hamiltonian just becomes lambda integral, so no integral, mu of t, phi of tx. Okay? So in the literature, you will often see this being called the Andrew DeWitt model. That was the original Andrew DeWitt model. Okay. Well, any questions so far about this approximation? This approximation is pretty good. In fact, this approximation generalizes all the models that people use in quantum optics nowadays, all the popular models, let's say. Any questions, as we will see in a minute? All right, something that we often do as well is, but we'll talk about that later, include a switching function, but we will talk about that a little bit later. That's going to be important later on when we talk about thermality and processes and all. OK, so let's see. What do people do? So this is what people did. Let's see if I can reset this to have the back one in the front. Ah, that one doesn't move, right? Then no. Sorry about that. Oh, and the middle one doesn't move anymore. OK. All right. So let's see what people do in quantum optics, the models that are common in quantum optics. So by the way, this was introduced, if you want, 1976 to 1979, where 79 corresponds to the Witt addition of saying, let's take just two levels instead of a cavity. All right, so what people use mostly, one of the most popular models, and then Aggie is here to correct me if I say something that's not accurate, is what is called the Jaynes-Cummins model. Several approximations, and there are some models in between. Jaynes-Cummins basically has two approximations made in it. So if you want the Jaynes-Cummins model, just take the Andrew DeWitt and do two approximations. Again, it wasn't developed through the Andrew DeWitt. You first go to something called a Rabi model, and then from Rabi model, there's a refinements in one way and approximations in another that is called the Glover model. And then Jaynes-Cummins basically does the simplest of the two kind of things that you would do. So the Jaynes-Cummins model can be understood, though, through take the Andrew DeWitt and do two approximations to it. Is Andrew DeWitt plus, or three approximations if you want, point-like, of course, plus single mode, plus rotating wave. So those are the names of the approximation: single mode approximation, rotating wave approximation. So let's see what we get when we do that. James Cummins, the Hamiltonian, is HI equals lambda sigma plus AK e to the I omega minus small omega k t. Remember, small omega k is modulus k in the units I'm using, plus sigma minus a dagger k e to the minus I omega minus minus omega k t. Right. So basically, if you see what's going on here, in the Andrew DeWitt model, we have a sum over all possible modes. Here. You have an integral over all possible frequencies, right? So the atom sees all the possible frequencies, kind of. We will talk a little bit about that, but sees all the possible frequencies, right? It's localized in space, so somehow the Fourier transform of the profile will show up and so on. But this thing is has an infinite number of modes, all the frequencies, right? And also, it's got, so the Andrew DeWitt model, if we do under a single mode, would become things like this, right? It would go like sigma plus AK e to the I omega minus omega KT plus sigma minus A K dagger, dagger e to the minus I omega minus omega K T plus sigma plus a dagger K e to the I omega plus omega K T plus sigma minus a K e to the minus I omega plus omega k t. So if we were to do a single mode, so the rationale is, OK, look, atoms have an energy gap. And that energy gap has some energy scale, right? And that scale, basically, well, we know that atoms are dominated by resonance, as in like the process in which an atom gets excited with external radiation is going to be dominated by resonance. And you do an experiment and say, yeah, let me shine red light to the hydrogen atom. Nothing happens. Let me shine a little bit yellower light to the atom, to the hydrogen atom. Nothing happens. And eventually, they hit the ultraviolet. The atom gets excited. So people say, why do we have to integrate over all frequencies if in the lab I'm kind of seeing that only one dominates? Let's do a single mode approximation. So if you were to do a single mode approximation on the Andrew DeWitt, you get this. Now, here's the thing. The single mode approximation alone, right, it's kind of clear that it's going to do something to causality, no? Because imagine, if a plane wave is everywhere, it's completely delocalized. If you couple only an atom to a single plane wave, then an atom that is space-like separated from it will couple to the same plane wave instantaneously, and there's no propagation whatsoever. It's only one mode. Whatever you do to the mode, you do to the mode somewhere else. There's no propagation. Removing all the expansion in plane waves, you removed all the propagation of the field. So definitely, with causality, that's going to be not going to be getting along pretty well. So the single mode feels a little bit rough if you actually want to do anything with a field that you actually put an atom there and things propagate and so on. Is that clear? That with a single mode, nothing propagates? It's like a harmonic oscillator, really. So you have an atom coupling here to a harmonic oscillator, an atom coupling here to the same harmonic oscillator. Nothing propagates. Yeah?
Yeah, but if you're in a cavity, do you still have those problems?
Oh, yeah, you do. In a cavity, if you do a single mode, you have a stationary wave. And an atom here at one side of the cavity couples to the same stationary wave, an atom on the other side, there's no propagation. If you have, You can have a propagating wave from atom A to another. Of course, a propagating wave can be expanded in a Fourier series. You need the infinite number of sine waves in the cavity in order to propagate from A to B. So if you do a single mode in a cavity, you still destroy causality. Yes. There's no propagation.
Yeah.
With all the modes in the cavity, there is propagation. With only one mode, there's no propagation. All right? So a single mode approximation, whether in a cavity or free space, destroys causality. All right. So the single mode approximation is done because experimentally there are setups where it seems that only one frequency is dominant. OK, and do we agree that that's pretty bad from the point of view of trying to do something relativistic with it? Do we agree or not, or questions, comments? Because again, we are negating the propagation of the field, so you get instantaneous signaling from A to B if you have only one mode. Right, let's try to see what happens with the single mode, the rotating wave approximation. In the rotating wave approximation, so in the unrotated wave model, we have these two terms. Let's call them rotating terms. And let's call these counter rotating terms. This is a quantum optics nomenclature. I'm not entirely sure why. I think the rationale goes as in like, oh, the harmonic oscillator is rotating opposite to the atom, but you call that rotating. And here is rotating exactly as the atom, the same direction. So you can counter rotate for some. Maybe you may be able to do that. That's a name they use. And they say, so this is something, again, quantum opticians know better. But this is something that is said in quantum optics classes. I've been in quantum optics courses where these things have been said. It's like, well, look at this. We have here two kinds of terms, right? We have terms of the form, right? These kind of terms, right? And these kind of terms, what do they do? So these kind of terms allow for the following process. You start from the vacuum state of the field, no photons, and the ground state of the detector. And through these kind of terms, you get some transition probability to a state with one photon, frequency k if you want, and an excited state of the atom. Agreed, people? And then you also have these terms. Let's say, yeah, let's do this one, a minus an A. So these ones enable this kind of process to happen, where you start with one photon, and zero photons, so the vacuum state and the excited state of the atom, and then you go to one photon and the ground state of the atom. Agreed? These are the kind of processes that the two kinds of terms evaluate. This is a rotating wave kind of process. This is a counter-rotating wave kind of process. Agreed, people? So this is an argument, again, that if you ever see it, you should say something about it. Let's see. The argument goes a little bit as follows. Right. Energy conservation. These things don't conserve. Oh, by the way, in particle physics, it's also used, this thing. In particle physics, it goes under the name of Fermi's golden rule. OK, it's very similar to Fermi's golden rule. And we will talk about when those things are correct. And Fermi's golden rule, by the way, do you, not people who took quantum with me, I guess, but do you people know who invented Fermi's golden rule? Who knows it? It was Dirac, not Fermi. Fermi was a very charismatic prof that when it was time, Fermi never attributed to itself the rule. Fermi was just teaching and said, computing this is impossible because we got infinities and things like that, but we can do one thing. We applied the golden rule, he said, and then the golden rule makes some assumptions. And the students, those students were famous students, will become famous students later on, and started calling it the golden rule. And in fact, Fermi's golden rule, because the prof that explained it to them called it the golden rule, and it was Fermi. But the person who actually suggested that was Dirac. Anyway, so conservation of energy kind of arguments. And in particle physics, people will tell you, this is the energy conservation delta. Have you heard those words before in particle physics? When they add a delta there in Fermi's golden rule and call it energy conservation delta? This is this thing. Eh? So I'm not talking about only on quantum optics here. Sorry. Not at all, neither. I mean, they usually know what they're doing. Definitely Aggie does, that I know. So you have here zero energy, right? Kind of the ground state of the atom and the vacuum state of the field. And here you have, all right, h bar omega plus h bar big omega kind of thing. Here you have zero plus h bar big omega. And here you have h bar omega plus zero, right? And then people say, right, this process, above all, if you're already single mode and on resonance, it's kind of consistent for a reason. It's kind of consistent with the single mode kind of thing. If you're on resonance, then big omega is equal to small omega, right? Agreed? And if you're on resonance here, you get that the energy here is h bar big omega. Here is h bar small omega. They're equal. Therefore, this thing conserves energy. This kind of processes conserve energy, people would say. And then they go here and say, oh, right, no. This process in particular, does not conserve energy. Because this makes sense, right? Because, oh, an atom that is excited decays and emits a photon. That is reasonable. And by reasonable, I mean we understand it from the classical intuition we have from before quantum. Things get excited, de-excited, and emit things, right? Whereas here, what happens is you have an atom in the ground state. You have the field with no photons, and suddenly the atom gets excited and emits a photon. So that's clearly violating energy conservation, right? I'm talking here, sorry. Gets excited and emits a photon. So clearly violating energy conservation, right? Who sees problems with that? Ah, tell me, yeah?
Well, whose energy are you violating?
Precisely. So what is the... So, remember, we have an interaction Hamiltonian here, and the interaction Hamiltonian has this form. The interaction Hamiltonian has this form, or if you want, has this form even in the after the single mode. And you also have a free Hamiltonian for the atom and for the field. What is the free Hamiltonian for the atom? So the free Hamiltonian for the atom, if you want, is of the form omega sigma plus sigma minus. So that the difference, so the ground state has energy zero, and the excited state energy big omega. And let's call it the harmonic oscillator, or the field mode that you have here. The free Hamiltonian is of the form small omega a dagger a after subtracting a zero point energy. So these Hamiltonians do not commute with the interaction Hamiltonian. So of course, they don't diagonalize in the same basis. So of course, these things that I wrote here are not eigenstates of the full Hamiltonian. Therefore, what is the point of assigning a value of energy to them? Makes no sense whatsoever to assign a value to them. You people agree? So this kind of reasoning is flawed in the sense that these things are not, are certainly not energy eigenstates to begin with. OK? Agreed, everyone? So the ground state of the atom makes sense when there's an atom alone. The ground state of the field makes sense when there's a field alone. It doesn't make sense when you have non-commuting Hamiltonians. Questions? So this is the problem of this argument. If you ever hear this argument, criticize it. Questions? All right. So now, the single mode approximation, this rotating wave approximation, imagine that I do a rotating wave approximation, but I don't do the single mode one. Obviously, the single mode approximation destroys causality, because one mode cannot transmit signals at a finite speed. Through one mode, you transmit signals instantaneously. Agreed, people? How about the rotating wave approximation? Do you think it violates causality, or it has problem with causality? Do you remember from your quantum field theory how to write a dagger and a as a functions of phi and pi? Have you seen that in quantum field theory? A of a given frequency k, an a dagger, can be written in terms of an integral of a sum of phi plus I pi, and integral of the sum of phi minus I pi. You remember that? So you can actually take the Andrew DeWitt under rotating wave approximation That means it's like, okay, forget about the single mode approximation. Let's keep all the modes, the infinite number of modes. Let's just do rotating wave approximation. Let's see if that makes any sense. Okay? Keeping all the modes and then rotating wave. Well, if that's the case, you can re-express the Hamiltonian. So here, the Hamiltonian is clearly local, right? The atom, look at this, the atom only acts on the field where the atom lives. The atom does nothing to the field outside of the support of the smearing function. Agreed, people? Following, everyone? Please stop me if not. Huh? The atom only touches the field wherever the atom lives. Right. So this is clear because this is a field operator. This is a local Hamiltonian. It couples the atom locally to the field. OK, if we expand in field modes like this, and then remove the terms, multiply these two things, and remove the terms that are called here counter-rotating terms, then we have it's no longer, you see, the Hamiltonian is no longer rank one, in a way. You're not going to have any more self-adjoint operator times self-adjoint operator. You're going to have non-self-adjoint operator times non-self-adjoint operator plus the conjugate, OK, if you do that. So it's definitely self-adjoint, the whole Hamiltonian, but it's no longer rank one, like this kind of. Not, if it were a point-like, it would be rank one. I mean, it's a field, so if you integrate and smear, no. But you know what I mean, right? Not only one term of two observables multiplied, you're going to have two terms, OK? And then those two terms, you can actually expand the A's. Because the A's and A daggers are not physical things. They're not self-adjoint operators. They don't represent observables. We can rewrite A and A dagger as a function of field observables. Agreed? Pi and phi, where pi is the canonically conjugate momentum to phi. Agreed, people? If you do that, then you find that the under the width and the rotating wave approximation, and I'm going to do the calculation. It's a very easy calculation. I want to do something else before leaving. So let me just tell you what the result is. So H, under the width interaction, which is equal, well, let me just write it like that. H rotating wave approximation, it's equal, just only doing the rotating wave approximation on the under the width, it's equal to 1/2 the under the width Hamiltonian minus 2i divided by 2 pi cube, then the mu, all right, which is this operator here. Ah, no, it's not the mu. Aha, sorry. It's almost the mu, but not the mu. And it's super important. Otherwise, I'm gonna get Andrew telling me if this is self-adjoint or not. So sigma plus minus e to the minus I omega t sigma minus, right. And then integral d3x, integral d3x prime of pi of t x prime divided by x minus x prime squared smearing function. So doing the rotating wave approximation alone, you get that the interaction Hamiltonian is, well, some Hamiltonian that we know is local, that couples the atom to the field only where the atom lives, and another term. And this other term couples the atom. This is kind of a sigma y rather than a sigma x. Anyway, couples the atom to the conjugate momentum of the field. But look at that. This is integrated not only, if it were integrated only over x, it would be a local coupling. But this is integrated over x prime. And it is integrated over x prime with a polynomial tail. So this Hamiltonian is non-local, and in fact, highly non-local. So polynomial tails rather than exponentially suppressed tails. So just doing the rotating wave approximation already destroys the causality of the model. An atom coupling here will can signal instantaneously to space-like separated regions through these tails under the rotating wave approximation. So if you care about relativity, you do not do the rotating wave approximation. This thing is ill. This is independent of how long you wait for the interaction, because we're going to talk about when the assumptions make sense. The, sorry, the, the rotating wave approximation and the single mode approximation make sense. After all, people use them in the lab and they work, right? So they may make sense in some regimes. This bit, the bit in which it violates causality, there's no regime which you can get rid of. You will always have polynomial tails leaking out of the light cone and the rotating wave approximation, okay? So no matter how long you wait, if you are close to the light cone enough to talk about space-like separation, even if you wait for long times, you're gonna have this problem. So the two usual, the James Cummings model is incompatible with relativity. It simplifies too much. Now you understand, I hope, why I call things relativistic quantum optics versus non-relativistic quantum optics. Because even though quantum optics is about light, if you work with models like that, you lost all the covariance of the model. Questions? Yep.
To get that expression, you just took phi with a single value of k, and then...
No. I didn't do a single mode here. So what I did is rewrite. So I would multiply the field times this. I will get four terms, right? This times this, this times that, this times this, this times that. I will throw out the counter-rotating terms, and I will rewrite a and a dagger as a function of phi and pi. And then you rearrange, commute a couple of things, and then you get the original under the width plus something else. And that something else is non-local.
But if you had kept those terms, it would still be local.
Yes, well, if I had kept those terms, it would be this, right?
Okay.
And this is local. So the James Cummings model violates causality either way. So if you have a model in which you do rotating wave but not single mode, still bad for relativity. More questions? Good questions, by the way. All right, so now what we're going to do, hopefully, in 20 minutes, is do a calculation where we compute, maybe I can do this too. No. Oh, sorry. Where we compute, we were going to consider a point-like atom, point-like detector, and we're going to compute quickly the transition probability from the ground to the excited state in the presence of the vacuum. So the vacuum excitation probability of a ground state detector. How about that? Within the James Cummings model, can you guys tell me what that probability is? Well, let's see. So we are going to compute the transition probability. Maybe I'll write it here. What is the transition probability from ground 0 to excited for the detector, and then anything for the field? Okay. Here's the thing. Let me introduce one more thing that is common and is used all the time in under the width models. If I write let me upgrade the under the width Hamiltonian with the following: lambda psi of t, and then d3x m dx field tx. What is this? This chi here, is the switching function. So basically, it's like the interaction can be turned on and off. And then you can tell that it's worthwhile discussing this. You can say, right, but the electromagnetic interaction is never turned off and on, right? Right. How do you make finite time computations in quantum mechanics? Like, if you, oftentimes in quantum mechanics, people take a time evolution operator and they start at T0 and end at T, right? Oh, right. So you're saying a particular case of this, where this is a top hat function. See what I mean? When you do actually integrals that are innocent all the time, T0 to T and things like that, you're not being innocent. You are picking a particular switching function. So the switching function involves, is important in the physics. If you do an interaction that is finite in time, right, like this, which is what quantum optics books would do when you do an integral from T0 to T, you're doing something huge and bad to the system. You are connecting the system, starting the interaction very sharply and discontinuously at the beginning, and ending up sharply at the end. And that is pretty unphysical. And the results, if you have different switching functions, change. This is, and we're going to talk about it, related to adiabaticity and related to how processes happen. Now, in the electromagnetic field, when we work in labs, we are doing switching processes all the time. We prepare the field and the atom, and we say, now is the vacuum, now is the ground state. This is a state preparation. That takes time, and this is kind of this. And then at the end, you measure the atom. That's also ending the interaction in some way. You can also have an atom in a Faraday cage, and you can release it, open it, and close it. That is a switching as well. So if you tell me the right thing to do is not to have the switching, I will tell you, yeah, well, if you go with that, then you will not be able to do calculations other than S matrix. And in S matrix, you better take both to infinity. And by the way, S matrix calculation probability are divergent in perturbation theory. Because for long times, perturbation theory fails most of the time. You know that, right? That probability transition calculations in S matrix are infinite. That's why people compute transition rates, rather. Agreed, people? There's a lot to chew in here, I think. All right, so anyone has any questions about this switching? Connecting the, so this generalizes what you've been doing in quantum mechanics all the time with interactions, if you want. If you want to still do an interaction from time 0 to t, or minus infinity to infinity, those are particular cases of this. Agreed, everyone? All right. Also, particle detectors can be switched on and off in real life. So this thing makes a lot of sense, I would say. You can argue with me if not, but this is something to think about a lot. You know, referees sometimes say, but what's the meaning of this, right? So it's not stupid to wonder what the switching function is. All right, so what time is it? OK, let's do a quick calculation in which we consider a transition round 2 excited in the presence of vacuum for the field. Okay? So let's do it first in the simplest kind of way, using Born's rule, because that's the way we compute probabilities in quantum mechanics. Agreed, people? And then we say, OK, yeah, the probability of going from ground to excited in the presence of the vacuum, it's equal to, right, so I have the probability of going. So I want to end with an excited state and any state for the field. And I have the time evolution operator with the coupling of light and matter. And then I start with the ground state and the vacuum. So that's the probability of doing a transition from the vacuum and the ground to excited and some out state of the field. Agreed? But then I don't care about the final state of the field, so I sum all the possible probabilities for any possible final state of the field. Agreed, everyone? OK. Now, this time evolution operator, of course, is the time order exponential of minus I integral from minus infinity to infinity dt h I of t. And I write minus infinity to infinity because the switching function, the support of the switching function, determines the integration domain. Agreed, everyone? OK. All right, so first thing we do a Dyson expansion. Let's do perturbation theory. Let's do the leading order in the coupling strength calculation. So let's expand U in terms of powers of the coupling strength, if you want. So sure, so this thing would be out, then E out identity plus U1 plus things of order lambda square. And then you have here G0. All right? Where U1 is the leading order term of the Dyson expansion of this. So U1 is the exponential of minus I integral dt hi of t. I'm computing the interaction picture, by the way. Agreed, everyone? All right. So quickly we see, I'm missing the modulus square. Quickly we see that the identity does nothing because ground and excited are orthogonal states. They're distinguishable states of the detector. Either detector with, yeah?
Sorry, I'm kind of confused. Should it just be the term in the exponential, not the?
Oh my god, yeah. Sorry. My bad. No, the one that's confused is me. Sorry about that. I just went with inertia. Okay, so the identity term does nothing, right? Because G and E are orthogonal. They're distinguishable state of the detector, whether detector with the arrow here or here, kind of thing. So the identity does not contribute here. U1 gives you the leading order contribution, which is lambda squared, by the way, because this is squared. Okay? So let's just expand that, and we get this is equal to out, and then we get, let me write this one first, because I want the vacuum first. So I'll write, I want the outer, so I'll write the other one, yeah. G0, U1, dagger, E out, E out, U1, G0. All right? It's just the modulus square expanded. All right, so we substitute this Hamiltonian, and we use the fact that the initial state is a product state. So the initial state, G0, and the final state is a product state too, is E out. Then we can separate by substituting U1. We get, let's see, sum over out for sure. And then I get two time integrals, dt. Let me just write all the reals. Dt prime, reals. And then I get chi of t prime. Okay. And then I get ground. Let's assume the detector is point-like. So to simplify things, for a point-like detector. So point-like, for the discussion now, we will not do that all the time. But for the discussion now, let's assume it's point-like, because I want to discuss the rotating wave and single mode approximation still. So if the detector is point-like, the smearing function is this delta here. And the Hamiltonian is just this with a switching function. So let me just write mu t excited. Mu is self-adjoint, so the dagger I don't need to write. And then you get here excited mu t. All right. And that thing multiplies to the following. You get out, so the vacuum. Then field out field vacuum. Do people agree? This is just substituting in the state. The smearing function is a delta function, and the initial state is separate. The final states here are separable. So just factoring things out. Yeah?
I think one of those t should be a t prime.
Oh my god, yes. I call t the one that is conjugate, say. And that means the second one? No, GE is the conjugate one. OK, I call t the one that's not the conjugate. All right, so people, this thing is easy to evaluate. This thing here is E. So let's see. Mu has the one that will give you from the right, acting on the excited state, you would get the sigma minus. So that would be E to the minus I omega T. OK? So you get I omega. And then you get, on this one, you get a minus T. And on this one, you get a T prime. Agreed, everyone? By substituting the mu. Agreed, people? OK. The other thing to realize is that this thing is the identity, is the sum over all possible out states. OK, so this is a spectral decomposition of identity. So this thing is a 1. So what we have here now is the following. This one doesn't go up, right? Or does it? Oh, it does. So nice. All right, so we get the following. We get, and I forgot the lambda square. Sorry about that. So what we get is lambda square, and then we get integral dt, integral dt prime, and then we get e to the I omega t prime minus t, okay? And then we get this thing here, phi tx, phi t prime x, where x is the position of the atom.
And the switching functions.
And the switching functions. So important. All right. OK, so let's look at this. This thing here is what we call the vacuum two-point correlator. The vacuum Weimar, what you see is a two-point correlator, right? It's also called the two-point Weimann function, or just the Weimann function. We will talk more about Weimann functions and what they are. They are not really functions, though. They're distributions. And in general, this is the two-point Weimann function. All the many-point Weimann functions are still called Weimann functions. But when you do calculations in particle detectors, people call this always the Weimann function. We can evaluate it. The vacuum Weimann function is very easy. We can evaluate it because on the vacuum, from the right, you're going to act with sigma plus. So you, oh, where's the field? Here. With a dagger, and that means you're going to get an IKT, positive. In this case, it's T prime. So let's evaluate, in this case, let's evaluate this guy. Phi of T x, phi of T prime x prime on the vacuum. This thing gives me a positive E, if you want, E to the I modulus k T minus kx, right? This is with a prime. This is coming from this acting on the vacuum. Agreed, people? Well, there's also constant factors that we will deal with later. And then we also have here, this one acts on the left, and acts on the left again with the dagger. So, right, oh, sorry. Well, whatever. This acts on the left with the annihilator in order not to give anything. So this thing will give me e to the minus I k t minus k x prime, x. All right? And I also have constant factors. So I get 1 over root 2 pi two pi cube modulus k. And I also get an integral over k. And in fact, all right. All right? So this is what you get when you when you compute this correlator. Now, of course, you would get, here's the, what I did very fast. You have two integrals over k, right? But if you want, you can do, you commute these two operators. You commute the A dagger acting on here and the A acting on here. You get a delta of k's, and the delta of k, that's one of the integrals. Or from the quantum optics perspective of computing, this creates a photon here, and then this annihilates a photon here with different frequencies. They're only non-zero when they're the same frequency. All right, so that's how you get rid of one of the integrals in k. There are two fields to integrals in k. All right, so this is the Wyman function. We can put everything together and write the following. What time is it, by the way? All right, lambda square dt, and then square root of 2 pi cube modulus k, right? And then I put the things together. The k's x special on the point that is evaluated in here cancel because it's the same point. It's only a delta interaction. Question?
It's not square root, but right? 35.
Oh my god. Of course. There are two fields, no one. My bad and really well seen. Yeah. Two fields, no one. Totally my bad. I just copied from there. So no square root, just a blurry thing in here. That's totally optional, only if you want to write it. And you get the following. So switching function. And then you get e to the I omega, right, omega plus modulus k, multiplying t prime minus t. If I'm not forgetting anything. I hope I'm not. Those things happen all the time, though. All right. Any questions? So look at what we have. The integrals over time, by the way, are on the whole real line, can be very quickly identified with Fourier transforms, right? Integral number one with respect to t is a Fourier transform that swaps omega and k. Integral number two is a Fourier transform that swaps omega and k. Agreed? All right, so what you get, one will give you the conjugate of the Fourier transform of chi. The other one gives you the Fourier transform of chi. So if we substitute that in, we get that the probability of transition is lambda square integral over all frequencies, 2 pi cube k. And then we get the modulus square of chi tilde omega plus modulus k square. And then I think that's it. Yeah. Perfect. So look at that. Look at this, and let the last minute, let's discuss this result. So this is the transition probability of starting from the ground state of the detector and the vacuum of the field and getting excited. And what we got is that, of course, let me just write chi tilde is the Fourier transform of chi tilde of omega is the Fourier transform I omega t chi of t. OK? Now, let's look at this from the point of view of the rotating wave approximation and single mode approximation. Now, you see that a detector does indeed get excited with some probability if it starts in the ground state, coupled to the vacuum, right? Right. That probability depends a lot on how smooth the switching is, right? Because the Fourier transform, depending on how smooth the switching is, will be more or less violent, more or less suppressing the higher frequencies. So how smooth the switching is controls what frequencies actually play in all the sum of frequencies, not all of them play. The number of frequencies that play here are related with the Fourier transform of the switching. So if your switching is Gaussian, there will be a suppression of the high frequencies that is Gaussian as well. If your switching is sharp, the suppression is a sink kind of suppression, because that's the Fourier transform. Oh, by the way, careful, because with a sink, this thing will have logarithmic divergences. That's something that we will discuss even better later on. So you have to be careful with your switching. It's dimension dependent, of course. Here's the thing. What would be the transition probability that we would have predicted under the rotating wave approximation, people? Remember the terms that contributed here. The terms that contributed here are the terms that excited, so you start in the ground state, right? So need to excite the detector and excite the field. Those are counter-rotating wave terms. Under the rotating wave approximation, the probability would have been a zero. Agreed, people? Right. Under the single mode approximation, that we agree. Now, another question. What happens if this is the transition probability that I did from ground to excited. Can I get the probability from excited to ground, which is the excitation probability from this expression? Or do I need to do the calculation again? I can do this. Omega from omega to minus omega. Transform this state, this process into this process. Agreed? Basically, changing the sign of omega swaps the gap. Now we have the excited state being the G state. Agreed? So we know already that the transition probability, so this is vacuum excitation. And we also get the vacuum emission, vacuum de excitation, for the same price. Agreed, everyone? This is the probability of the excitation stimulated by the vacuum. By the way, you know in classical physics that if you have nothing, the atom will never, ground state of the electromagnetic field, you will never see an atom de-excite, classically. It's fluctuations that induce the de-excitation. So this is a vacuum-induced de-excitation. Right. So let's see. Rotating wave approximation predicts no probability of vacuum excitation. And the probability of the excitation under the single mode approximation, it would be like, well, you see, look at this. If we do the calculation under the rotating wave approximation, we actually get the same value here. This one is the same. And the point is that what happens when the interaction is very long? Well, let's think of the interaction being very long, like infinitely long. What would be the Fourier transform? What would be the Fourier transform of the switching like when the interaction is infinitely long? It's a delta, no? People, you know that. It's a delta. Right. So if the interaction is infinitely long, this integral is going to be contributing less and less and less for all the frequencies outside of the same as omega. So here's the resonance happening. This mechanism of resonance means like, well, if your switching is long enough, then of all the sum of the overall possible frequencies, only one survives. The one that has a field frequency equal to the energy gap. That's your resonance right there. And also tells you, well, for long times, the probability of vacuum excitation is zero, because you would get a delta again, but the delta of an argument that's always positive. Agreed? So that delta never crosses zero. Therefore, that delta never contributes. It's a zero exactly in the long time limit. So the results that you get for transition probabilities for the rotating wave approximation and the single mode approximation are the same results that you get with the SAT model when the interaction time is long. For long interaction times, you recover the single mode approximation and rotating wave approximation. Only for the detector. If you care about what you did to the field, still bad. Because what I told you, violations of causality, the states of the field are not the same. But if you care about the detectors, about the physics of the atoms, definitely the long time regime recovers the rotating wave and the single mode approximation. OK? Clear to everyone? All right. So this is going to be the basis of what we're going to do next. Because what we have done so far, and let me just say one thing, what we have done so far, you realize that I have a T and an X all the time, right? And I promised that this would be relativistic. What the heck, right? So detectors are only fun if detectors can move. And it can move in arbitrary trajectories, right? So what does that mean in that case? Because I'm writing things very happily, like, oh, here's an interaction Hamiltonian. Here's a free Hamiltonian. Hamiltonians are not innocent objects. Hamiltonians are generators of time evolution. Hamiltonians are associated with a partial T. and different partial t's or partial tau's different times, you cannot talk about the same Hamiltonian. If a Hamiltonian generates a translation with respect to t, it will not generate a translation with respect to tau. So if we want to do, also we have the problem that the atom is an extended object, no? The detector is extended. If we want to move in non-inertially, you did an assignment or a tutorial exercise yesterday about that being tricky and so on, right? So we need to take into account many things in order to really upgrade this to relativity. What we've been doing here is having a field. We have quantized the field in an inertial frame, call it lab frame, right? We use T and X. And we have an atom that's commoving with that frame. Well, luckily, the theory is Lorentz invariant, so it could be any inertial atom if you want, if the state of the field is Lorentz invariant, like the vacuum. But we haven't yet included that the atom can move at relativistic speeds. The atom can be on an accelerated trajectory. So this, how to deal with that, it's not easy. Quantum optics doesn't do that. Like, there's no book in quantum optics that does that. For that, we need to upgrade a little bit our notions of what it means to write an interaction Hamiltonian, what it means to write a free Hamiltonian with respect to what times those Hamiltonians generate translations, and how does a Hamiltonian transform under Lorentz transformations or general transformations of coordinates. So this is the next thing we're going to do. I think that's it. If you have any questions, please come ask me. Thank you.